this morning is Redwood against Dobson. Ms. Redwood.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court and Counsel. The District Court repeatedly invaded the province of the jury by deciding which material facts to believe and finding summary judgment against the plaintiff appellant in this case. Beginning with the incident on October 1, 1998, the facts of that incident are in dispute, yet the court repeatedly gave credit to the defendant's version of those facts. In a conspiracy case, it's very important that the facts go to the jury. Summary judgment is almost never found in a conspiracy case unless there's absolutely no material facts that could credit the plaintiff's allegations.
Ms. Redwood, I wouldn't phrase it quite that way. There are a lot of conspiracy cases that are subject of summary judgment motions, and what you need is some evidence that tends to exclude the hypothesis that people are behaving based on their individual interest. If you have a piece of evidence, you know, the sun rose at 6:30 this morning, and it's just as consistent with conspiracy as it is with independent action, that piece of evidence doesn't move the ball. It just doesn't help you exclude the possibility that people are acting on their own. What evidence of that sort do you have?
I think that the most important evidence is that the incident occurred on October 1st, 1998.
Why does that tell me that there was a conspiracy?
Because the criminal prosecution didn't occur until a year later, and nothing had taken place in that intervening year except that Redwood had filed a civil lawsuit against Welch for civil torts. Thereafter, Welch, who's an attorney, went to another attorney. We have three attorneys here. There are meetings which are documented in our brief, which the court discounted prior to the indictment, pre-indictment meetings. And then they went to the grand jury. The intervening year, when the incident occurred on 10-1 of 98, Welch never mentioned anything about racial slurs. He never mentioned to the reporting officer anything about Redwood yelled across the street anything about Shoeshine Boy.
Let me ask you this, please. What would you say is Mr. Redwood's single best piece of evidence of a conspiracy? Because a good portion of your brief discusses meetings and communications between the various parties. But even if these parties met many, many times over the course of the year that preceded the hate crime charge, it wouldn't matter unless there is evidence that they were meeting for the purpose of conspiring to deprive Mr. Redwood of, you know, his constitutional rights.
The single most important is the intervening year. However, in this particular case, we have alleged as the co-conspirators attorneys. Between them, almost 100 years legal experience. It's very easy for them to hide what they were talking about or not leave evidence or trail of it.
How that helps you, though, because as the plaintiff, you still have the burden of finding evidence. You can't say, well, people were just so good at hiding it, I should win without any. I mean, it just isn't the way the system works.
I think that the evidence, the different pieces of evidence, are detailed in the brief. And I think that the importance is that when all the pieces come together, there is enough evidence. And I think that it needs to go to the jury. It may be that the jury will decide exactly as the district court decided, that the evidence doesn't support conspiracy. However, the district court does not have the prerogative to put himself in the jury's shoes and decide which facts to believe. And from reading the opinion, it's very clear that that's what the court did. Instead of discussing what the evidence was and why no reasonable jury could believe it. He merely ignored a lot of the evidence, sidestepped it, and just said this is what happened. His entire opinion was based on what he believes was the fact that the plaintiff yelled across the street, "When are you going to stop being a shoeshine boy?" when in fact that is a fact in dispute, and it's even disputed by Mr. Welch. He never reported to Officer Searles on the day of the incident that anything was said about shoeshine boy. He never mentioned the word. He never mentioned that the N-word was said some time in the past. He never mentioned this was racist. He mentioned this was all about a case. I think that Officer Searles' report is very instructive on the issue because he's not a party to anything here. He's simply a police officer who's reporting what the different parties told him. Everything morphed within the year after the civil lawsuit was filed, and I think that's very important for a jury to understand and to try to determine why did this happen. When we look at the grand jury transcript, the jurors were not told that the intervening events was the filing of a lawsuit. The grand jurors were told by Officer Phillips that Welch had been continually harassed at his home in the intervening year. Phillips knew that was not the truth. In the intervening year, Redwood had never spoken to Welch. They had incidental meetings in court. It's in the depositions. Welch admits it several times that Redwood never approached him. There were incidental meetings in court, and he got a letter from me, which was a settlement demand on the civil lawsuit. He says, "Well, I got that letter, and I got the idea that there might be some future harassment, so I went to get this criminal charge." I think that the jury has a right to take a look at that and see what they think. The plaintiff has a constitutional right to have a jury hear his lawsuit, and I think that the evidence taken together needs to go to the jury. And that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying, hey, we're going to win a million gazillion dollars. I'm saying the people of the Central District of Illinois need to take a look at this. They need to see what we're alleging, that there are three attorneys who somehow got together. They had meetings, which they won't talk about what they said at the meetings. They refused at deposition. Some of them didn't remember that they had these meetings. Others said, "I had one meeting." When the officers' reports, and I'm going a lot by the officers' reports, because they're officers. They're trained to write a report, what people said to them, and so it's very compelling evidence, I believe, what was in Officer Phillips' report when he said that he had several meetings. The attorney said, "No, I had one meeting." There's letters that go between. Now, in the case, under the Rule 26 disclosures, Ms. Dobson, the assistant state's attorney, provided what she said was the entire prosecution file. There was one letter in there from Marvin Gerstein. Although she had testified back in 2001 that she had already received a couple of letters and had a couple of phone calls from Marvin Gerstein, she provided only one letter. Later at deposition, Marvin Gerstein provided four letters that he had sent to Ms. Dobson, which were not in the prosecution file in discovery. One of the letters that Ms. Dobson did not provide stated from Mr. Gerstein to Ms. Dobson, "Dear Elizabeth, it is wrong for me to believe that Mr. Redwood should be hit by a car." Why in the world would an attorney who's simply communicating, as he says, about depositions and scheduling things, write that kind of a thing to an assistant state's attorney? Now, at deposition, when asked about it, he said, "Oh, I said that I was wrong and I didn't think he should be hit by a car." Well, come on, who's he trying to kid? Everybody can read that who's got an ounce of brains and know what he's saying. He's being sarcastic, he's being arrogant. The jury needs to ask those questions. I have a right to go to the jury for myself, for my client, and say, why was he saying this? Is this just a normal course of business? If this is the normal course of business in Champaign County, well, something's pretty wrong here, because that's inappropriate. The district court just made the assumption that Redwood yelled across the street and called Welch a shoeshine boy. That's what probable cause was decided on, a disputed fact. The 10-198 utterance was material to the court's qualified immunity analysis, and it's a material fact that's in dispute in this case. In regards to probable cause, Dobson stated, well, I decided that there was probable cause, so I sent it to a grand jury because there's a community input. That's nice rhetoric, but it's really got to be for a jury to decide whether it's the truth or not. If she decided she had probable cause, why did she send Phillips to talk to Welch to determine if any hate crime had been committed? I see I'm going over my time. I'll reserve the rest for my rebuttal.
Good.
Thank you.
Mr. Hill.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Keith Hill, and I represent the defendant appellee, Elizabeth Dobson.
I'm going to just start you right out. I'm going to start you out with one of those statistic questions.
Sure.
Is there anything in the record about the number of hate crimes that the Champaign County State's Attorney's Office prosecuted in the year or two before and after the Redwood case? I'm wondering if Ms. Dobson had ever prosecuted any hate crimes, before this one.
Unfortunately, we're in the same position as the prior case, Your Honor. There's no evidence of that in the record, so I cannot answer your question directly. The district court, or this court, should affirm the district court.
But can you tell me if Ms. Dobson had ever prosecuted a hate crime previously?
There's nothing in the record that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Maybe the other attorneys may be able to help you, but there's nothing in the record that I'm aware of.
Because, yeah, it's very difficult for me to imagine that a prosecutor with, Ms. Dobson's experience could think that yelling a racial epithet in and of itself could create or constitute a hate crime.
Well, I'll address that issue. The plaintiffs did not challenge whether it constitutes a hate crime. They only challenged whether or not this was a protected speech under the First Amendment. And that's the issue, is whether or not there were fighting words. And they argue that the fighting words have to contain an explicit or implied threat. And I put forward to you that they do not, that they merely have to be personally abusive epithets that, when addressed to the ordinary citizen, are, as a matter of common knowledge, inherently likely to provoke a violent reaction. And I argue that calling an African-American man a shoeshine boy is such words. And then you take that in the context of the situation. Mr. Redwood reportedly had a history of harassing and insulting Welch, and using another racial slur in referring to him. So that only magnified the likelihood of a violent reaction. And in fact, there was a violent reaction. Mr. Welch reportedly crossed the street and confronted Mr. Redwood, and a breach of a peace occurred. And he also told Dobson at the time he spoke with her that he felt alarmed and disturbed. He considered this to be a racial slur. So that gave Dobson probable cause to believe that there was hate crime predicated on disorderly conduct, which is why she's entitled to qualified immunity in this case.
Your opponent argues that Ms. Dobson crossed the line from prosecutorial functions to investigatory functions such that she forfeited her absolute prosecutorial immunity. She was, she not, directing the police officer in his investigation into the incident?
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't call it an investigation. What you have here is you have a police report that, and I disagree with the plaintiff's contention that there's nothing in the prior police report, that would be the Searles police report, about this being harassing conduct. I think if you read the police report, Mr. Welch does say that he was being taunted. He did say that the words were hurting him. He did say that he crossed the street to confront Mr. Redwood to make his point across, and then it says in parentheses, harassing conduct. So I think the Searles report does reference the harassing conduct. But when Dobson talked to Welch and he described his hate crime, she then got the police report, Searles report, and she read it, and it did not go through. It just really discussed the battery. So she needed an officer, because grand jury sessions are done by the hearsay testimony investigators, she needed an officer to come testify on behalf of Welch and present the state's case. So all she did was call the Urbana Police Department and ask for an investigator to be assigned, and Officer Phillips happened to be that person. Officer Phillips was not investigating a crime. He was merely going to speak on behalf of Welch, and that's what the task for him to do was. This was not a supplemental police investigation. This is the type of conduct that is so intimately associated with the judicial phase of the criminal process that it does, in fact, warrant absolute immunity.
No, but isn't that just semantics? Of course he was doing some additional explanation or investigation. He didn't just take the Searles report and sit there and read it to the grand jury. There, he fleshed it out. He asked other people a few more questions. He had his own contribution. I don't see why we can't call that an additional look at the case.
It may be semantics, Your Honor, but there's nothing that Officer Phillips gathered from Officer Welch that Prosecutor Dobson was not already aware of. He needed someone to speak for Welch. She could not do it. In the Searles report, you can't just read the Searles report to the grand jury. Again, the Searles report does reference the conduct, but not in the specifics that they needed to present to the grand jury. So she did ask Officer Phillips to go talk to Welch and get that information that she had. And then he did a police report on that particular conduct and submitted to Dobson, and then we proceeded with the grand jury. So I do think that she's entitled to absolute immunity on that as well. And for the reasons I just discussed earlier about the hate crime, I think she's also entitled to the qualified immunity.
What is a defendant's remedy if a prosecutor wholly misinforms a grand jury about the requirements of the law, even if it's done unintentionally?
Well, I don't believe there's any remedy for the against the prosecutor. I think the prosecutor does have absolute immunity.
What I asked is, you know, what is the defendant's remedy?
I'm sorry?
What would it, the, is there a remedy for such a defendant? When you've got, you know, a prosecutor who doesn't know the law.
Well, I don't believe that Harris mischaracterized the law in this case, for one. And, I think
well,
that...
Well, but maybe there's no remedy. I mean, you right. started to say that.
I think that's true against the prosecutor.
If there is a remedy, then what is it? And if there isn't a remedy, you have to just fess up and say there's no remedy.
There is no remedy against the prosecutors. I do think absolute immunity. No, excuse me?
The prosecutor is incompetent. You expose this to the public and have the prosecutor thrown out of office and replaced with somebody who will either be competent himself or hire competent deputies.
I think that's right.
Oh, good.
Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. As to the conspiracy claim, the primary evidence relates to these communications that Phillips, Welch, and Dobson had. Now, note here that there's no, they can only speculate regarding the nature of these communications. And the cases cited by Dobson and Gerstein on this issue are directly on point, that mere contacts and mere communications or mere opportunity to conspire without more is insufficient to infer a conspiracy. And the case cited by plaintiff is distinguishable in that regard. They cite the Lamb case. In that case, the police met, but they also met and planned how they're going to be handling the demonstration, which was the very thing that they were being sued for. So I think Lamb is clearly distinguishable from this case. And you also have the Atticus v. Crest case, which is also distinguishable. In that case, there was an unexplained gap in the evidence. Although the store owner or the store manager testified that he did not speak with the police officer, the other store employees and the police officers themselves were unable to foreclose the possibility that they spoke and might have influenced how they're going to not serve Ms. Atticus. In this case, there's no such gap in the evidence. All the alleged co-conspirators have testified or indicated as such that they did not participate in this conspiracy. There's really no gap in the evidence. The final thing that they rely on is letters from Attorney Gerstein to Attorney Redwood asking to settle, and in a conversation Attorney Redwood had with Dobson and Gerstein outside the courthouse. As to the letter, any rational reading of that letter leads the reader to the conclusion that Gerstein's not promising, he's only promising to contact Dobson in the future and attempt to persuade her to dismiss the criminal case, not that such a conversation has already occurred or that they already have an agreement as to that. And then as to the conversation the three of them had outside the courthouse, Gerstein suggested that, hey, if your client agrees to dismiss the criminal charges against, excuse me, the civil suit against my client won't testify against your client in the criminal case. That merely just suggests that Mr. Gerstein was, in fact, trying to settle this suit and try to have everyone walk away and be, you know, done with this whole matter. And then Dobson's comment that, hey, if I don't have a complaining witness, I can't proceed with the criminal suit just establishes a rather obvious fact that without a complaining witness, you probably can't proceed with this case. And so there's really no evidence of a conspiracy.
And so prosecutors not have subpoena power?
I'm sorry?
Prosecutors not have subpoena power?
They do have subpoena power.
So you could proceed with the case, could you?
Oh, you could proceed with the case, yes, Your Honor. But if the, you know, the person is unwilling to testify, it makes it rather difficult. So you know, Dobson is pointing out facts.
Was he threatening to lie?
Sorry, Your Honor?
Was he threatening to start lying if put under subpoena?
I'm not suggesting Mr. Wells would lie or that he would be uncooperative. I'm just merely pointing out that it would be difficult for Dobson to proceed without a witness who is willing to participate, wanting to participate. If Welch was not desiring to participate in this suit any longer, she would have no reason to proceed. It doesn't suggest in any way that there was an agreement to go violate constitutional rights.
In this line of argument, like, this prosecutor never prosecutes murder cases because the victims never cooperate in murder cases.
Well, I don't mean to imply that, Your Honor. I think that, you know, the conduct...
This is a serious problem in domestic violence cases where prosecutors take the line, if the husband bullies the wife enough so that she stops cooperating, the prosecutor drops the case.
Sure.
I mean, that attitude has led to a serious problem in the United States, and your argument suggests that your client has that attitude, which can't be right.
I don't think my client had that attitude. She's just merely expressing this to the fact that, hey, if I don't have a complaining witness, I probably won't be proceeding with this matter. It was within her discretion whether to proceed or not. Welch wanted the case, brought the case to her initially. She decided there was probable cause to prosecute it. If he was willing to not proceed with it, then she was willing to let go of it as well. And for the foregoing reasons, Your Honor, Elizabeth Dobson respectfully requests that this court affirm the district court's order granting summary judgment in her favor and against the plaintiff. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Mr. Weber.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Roger Weber on behalf of defendant appellee Marvin Gerstein. To touch on one of the questions that was first put forth by the court, there is no evidence in this record that Ms. Dobson or the Champaign County State's Attorney's Office has filed or pursued hate crime cases, but I'm reasonably confident a search of the clerk's records would indicate that they have on multiple occasions. I can't give you any specific numbers, but I'm confident that those would be found. I intended to address the state court claims because those were not covered by Mr. Hill at all, and they are very similar to the conspiracy claims in that what we have is an overwhelming lack of evidence to support any of them. For example, on the defamation claim, the suggestion is that a conversation took place between Mr. Gerstein and another attorney, Mark Lipton, and then after that conversation about the Redwood Welch lawsuit, and this lawsuit, that somehow Mr. Lipton stopped being nice to Mr. and Mrs. Gerstein. That there's no suggestion as to even what statement was made, let alone that that statement was false and led to any kind of injury. I think that each of the state court claims suffers from similar lack of evidence. There's just nothing to connect a conspiracy among all of these people. I'd also like to address the request for sanctions that was filed pursuant to the conclusion of the Gerstein deposition. It's alleged in the motion that I objected numerous times. I can't recall the count, and I did. It's also alleged that I instructed the witness not to answer questions for reasons other than attorney-client privilege, and that is true. There were multiple...
Of course, that instruction is specifically forbidden by the federal rules. Why should we tolerate it?
Well, some of the instructions were for other privileges besides, such as the mental health code. I believe that's a privilege, and to suggest that that is not a privileged basis for instructing a witness to answer, I think, is disingenuous by plaintiff's counsel. But the court is correct. The rule does say that for things such as relevancy or abusing the discovery process, the correct procedure is to halt the proceeding and go seek a protective order. The Gerstein deposition was taken after the close of discovery by agreement of all of the parties. We were well into this case. We were in the federal courthouse.
Is that the one where you pulled Magistrate Bernthal off the road?
No, actually, that one was the Harvey Welch deposition.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right.
But
right.
We were in the courthouse in the same room for the same reasons that the plaintiffs requested it be set there in case of a problem with discovery. At the very initial outset of that deposition, Mr. Danner started presenting a stack of what appeared to be traffic docket sheets that were not certified. There was no foundation for those, and Once Mr. Gerstein got to the point where he said, I don't recall whether these involved me or not, I don't remember 16 years ago, Mr. Danner just continued to beat on that point and harass him. And then he got into the ARDC complaints and Mr. Gerstein's sexual preference. And I believed it to be a clear violation of Rule 30D. The plaintiffs could have gone and sought a motion to compel. And in fact, they indicated at the end of that deposition they intended to certify the record. They never did. They waited and filed a motion for sanctions. The cases that they cite where sanctions were awarded, I think, are cases where there's far more outrageous conduct. Defendants just refused to answer discovery at all. They never showed up for depositions after they'd been specifically...
You haven't addressed my question. It may be that the plaintiff's conduct was sanctionable, too. But why should we give the defendant a free pass on conduct that is a clear violation of the federal rules just because the other side is also engaged in inappropriate behavior during a deposition?
I don't think I'm suggesting that we're entitled to a free pass for a clear violation.
Well, free pass is exactly what you got. The district court said, a pox on both houses, motions denied.
But, Your Honor, the cases involve sanctions talk about not only does there have to be a violation, but there have to be other circumstances warranting the sanction, outrageous behavior and things of that nature. It's my suggestion that the trial court correctly exercised...
No, that's not what the rule says. Rule 37 says that sanctions for violation of the discovery rules are automatic. Now, it may be that there's no demonstrable incremental cost to the plaintiffs from your misconduct, and therefore the optimal sanction is just something in the nature of tisk-tisk, a public reprimand, for example.
Or the court could have ordered us to answer the questions that we were objecting to at a motion.
That gets away from the whole point of the rules, right? If the rule says you cannot instruct your client not to answer on any basis other than privilege, if you say the only response is the court now tells me to follow the rule, that's just to say that there's no sanction.
Well, but
and then you can always say, I instruct you not to answer.
But the rule also says that I can halt the proceeding and go seek a protective order. And since we were past the cutoff for discovery, I did not choose to do that. And I see that I'm past my time unless there are other questions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Anything further, Ms. Redwood?
As a matter of fact, Ms. Dobson did prosecute a hate crime, People versus Ian Martin, where I was defense counsel, and Mr. Martin actually took his shirt off at a high school where there was a racial incident going on, Champaign Central High School, and said, come on, give me some, I'm going to get into this. That was a hate crime that she actually prosecuted. She knew the law about hate crime. He hadn't actually fought, but he had engaged in a type of a threat to fight by taking off his shirt, assuming a fighting stance, and he pled to that. Ms. Dobson asked for an investigator. The investigator went to determine if there was any hate crime. She didn't tell him, in his report anyway, and he says, I was sent to see if there was anything that constituted a hate crime, not to get some additional facts. The other things that she did in directing his investigation, and he did in deposition before he lawyered up, said, yes, she was directing my investigation. She told me not to interview Mr. Redwood. She told me not to interview Mr. Redwood's witness. Mr. Redwood is the only person who provided to Officer Searles a witness with a telephone number on the date that it happened, yet that witness wasn't interviewed. So she was acting in her investigative capacity. In regards to the question of the court that the proper way to handle this is to basically throw the bums out, that's exactly what happened. Mr. John Pyland was... thrown out of office by the voters after this and many other scandals involving his office and Ms. Dobson in particular. Ms. Dobson subsequently chose to resign rather than be fired by the new state's attorney, and she is now practicing in a different county. There are gaps in the evidence here. Reading the depositions carefully, you see that the defendants choose not to remember things. I don't remember if those meetings happened. I don't remember what we talked about. Instead of stating if he talked to Harvey Welch about getting Eric Redwood prosecuted for a crime, Marvin Gerstein said, no, I'm not going to answer that question. The jury has a right to see him sweat up on the stand. Did you talk to Harvey Welch? Let him tell the jury, no, I'm not going to answer that question. Let them see what these people look like when they're on the stand. When Ms. Dobson was answering questions, I'll tell you right now, her legs were shaking. The jury needs to see that. That's all that we're asking, to take it to a jury. I think that there's plenty enough circumstantial evidence to take it to a jury. Ms. Dobson's statement to me in the courthouse that obviously I don't have a case if I don't have a witness. Judge Easterbrook pointed out exactly what I was going to point out. Champaign County State's Attorney's Office routinely takes domestic cases to the jury when they have a woman who refuses to testify and they put her on the stand. And Ms. Dobson was known for that. She's a tough prosecutor. She was representing the people of the state of Illinois, not just one or two persons, not just Harvey Welch or Marvin Gerstein. She was representing the people of the state of Illinois, and if she felt that this was an important enough case to call a hate crime, to call a class 4 felony, to put in the newspaper against a person who's a reverend, and then she's going to back out of it and say, oh, well, if I don't have a witness, obviously I can't prosecute this. And for the judge to say, it's pretty obvious. I was surprised when the district court said, well, it's pretty obvious she just can't proceed if she doesn't have a witness. I don't think so. I think the jury needs to hear that. Why couldn't you prosecute? Why was it so important to you to prosecute this case, and then suddenly you decide that you're not going to? There was nothing new that she had heard. She just had a witness who said, hey, you know, we're going to settle out this civil case. Well, good, you did your job. That's what I want to tell the jury. She did her job. She held the sword over his head until it was time to settle the case. And then Harvey Welch says, let's settle it. And she said, okay, I did my job. Your Honors, for all the reasons stated in the briefs and oral argument, we stand on our motions, the arguments in our motions. We ask that this case be sent to the jury, please. We also ask that the judge's ruling on attorney's fees pursuant to Section 1988 be affirmed. Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.